everyone. Welcome back. You've made it to episode 7 of Behind the Science of Career Development. This is your host, Brian Hutchison, aka the Global Career Guy, and the editor of the Asia Pacific Career Development Journal. Now, an issue of the journal will have just come out this past month, so please check it out as we continue to develop and share excellent scholarship about and throughout the Asia Pacific region. I'm so excited today to have, I think, someone that many of our listeners will know well. I would say an old friend in the field and someone who I've learned a lot from as a mentor, Dr. Marilyn Mays. Many of the listeners will know her as the founding and past executive director of the Asia Pacific Career Development Association. I'm going to ask you to introduce yourself, Marilyn, but I want you to talk about some things that people might not know about you. So I want to go away from the APCDA role. How do you look back and sort of capture the essence of your career in career development thus far?
Well, I started my life as a math teacher, and then I decided that I wanted to work on people problems, and so I became a counselor. And my first work was with computerized career planning, which I did that for 30 years. I cannot believe that, but 30 years passed while I tried to create the best computer-assisted career guidance program in the world. And I ended up at ACT and worked with them until they got out of that business and decided to narrow their focus and work on assessing people to enter college, which is, of course, their main product. And then I decided I had to do something completely different because they owned my soul. You probably know about non-compete agreements in corporations. Mm-hmm. Sure. So now I'm working with the Asia Pacific Career Development Association instead and having a lot of fun.
So you were really there in the heyday of what I consider like generation one of computer-assisted career guidance.
Back in the beginning, in the 1970s, we used to plug the telephone into something that looked like a typewriter. And what came out then was a bunch of thermal paper with some typing on it.
So I think you might relate to this. I still remember, and I'm probably the last generation that remembers, but when I took computer programming in high school, we had to punch cards with a stylus to solve the problems that we were programming into the computer. Have you punched a few hanging chads in your day?
Oh, you bet. And in fact, I dropped a few decks and had to put them back in order. That was horrible.
I know. Why did they never put a numerical system on the punch cards? Because when you drop them and they get mixed up, you have to start over, right?
They thought about that later.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. So this episode, I'm super excited because as I think you're a listener, Marilyn, we've really been trying to sort of change the dynamic of the conversation on the podcast for 2021. And just as a plug, a new episode is coming out, I think today or tomorrow, that really captures that focus on persons with disability. And then this is going to be our April episode. And so, hi, everyone. Welcome to April 2021. We're not there yet, Marilyn and I. We want to have a different kind of conversation. And it's really, in my mind, based on you have a series of questions or maybe even call them concerns about sort of the compass point and the direction of career work. Could you talk a little bit about what prompted you to contact me about and to describe this sort of conversation that you're wanting to have?
Well, I know that the webinars we offer may seem to the attendees as being rather random in their topics. Of course, a lot of that has to do with who's willing to give us a talk when. But we have been working on trying to get some of the major theorists recorded and trying to think about where are we headed in terms of career planning and what kind of different perspectives in terms of direction are out there. And there's been a whole lot of change going on recently and a huge focus on change. And so I want to talk about what might be the future and of course might not be the future.
Right, great. And when the conversation came up with us, it felt like it was really centering around sort of theoretical approaches or the models that people want to implement. Is that
accurate? That's correct. Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. And I know as someone who's been training counselors for a couple of decades now and coaches, you know, I really think this is an important conversation. The research shows that the theory or the model that we choose isn't that important, except for that it's important to us. And so when we've done comparison studies of approaches that are validated, the approaches across groups of people tend to have the same outcome, the same level of effectiveness. And so I've always centered it on you, the counselor, you, the coach, are the one that needs the theory, so that it is giving you boundaries in your mind about what it is that you're doing and practicing consistently over time, and sort of helps you evaluate this process of counseling and coaching, because you don't really have feedback loops.
I've been doing this for 50 years. And what I see is that the people I studied and learned about when I first started are still being studied and learned about. And yet people coming in now don't have the same feeling I do about them, because I knew them as people who are even older than I am.
Sure.
And have since passed away. And so I have some sense of history. And I think a lot of people just entering the field aren't able to put people in perspective in that way.
Yeah, yeah. And so as soon as you say put people into perspective, I automatically go to the developmental tree of career approaches, career theories. And of course, one of the fathers, I guess, if Parsons was the grandfather, then I think that Don Super is certainly one of the fathers of modern approaches to career work. Is he a big influence in your career and in your thinking?
Yes, certainly. This is how I was trained. And his stages of career development, I think, influenced our thinking for many years. And in fact, they spawned on this concept that he brought out called career maturity. Mm-hmm. So we were all starting at the beginning, exploring and then crystallizing and then gaining maturity. We don't talk about that anymore. And so some of that may seem like it's really old and male-centered, quite frankly.
Yeah.
But however, what I think is happening now is that we're still leaning on standing on the shoulders of Donald Super. And we look back at his work and see, yeah, there's a lot of good sense in there. And a lot of that is very helpful foundationally.
Yeah. And I think what I worry about is if people have too superficial of a viewpoint, right? And so like a lot of people think developmental theory, career maturity, it's basically your age determines how mature you are. And he really presented the idea as your maturity for the task in the moment.
Correct.
Right? And so you can be 45 and have a career transition issue and still be immature for 45 because that task is sitting there in front of you.
Exactly. But now we call that adaptability, and we say that life is constantly changing and we need to keep adapting to whatever life throws at us.
And adaptability, I see the relationship between the two, but there is an input variable of how ready you are to adapt. Do you have the skills and the preconditions? And so that might be one way to sort of tease out career maturity from adaptability, even though that they're closely related, I think.
Exactly. And I still think career maturity has validity, as you said, because if you don't have the skills to begin with, you're not going to be able to adapt very well. So, yeah.
I think another important aspect of Super's work that's easily missed is too often today when people teach Super, they're still putting the age ranges on those developmental stages.
Yes.
And that's sticking in people's heads.
Right.
Was it in the 80s, I think, that he abandoned the age ranges?
Yes, I think that's right.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so like now what that does is it frees us up to think about people developmentally as sort of recycling through some of the stages.
Right.
Right. And so, you know, I think easy examples are someone because of the pandemic is pushed out of a career field because maybe it's shrinking or it's rebounding out of the pandemic differently. Their maturity to start a job search, let's say for the first time in 20 or 30 years, is going to be more like that of an 18-year-old possibly than that of a 50-year-old.
That's really true. And so what Super was trying to talk about was moving through stages, but because he was caught in a period of time in the 50s when everybody wore a hat on their head and a suit on them and went to work with a briefcase, that he just really saw life in these categories. And now we look at that and go, not quite so much.
Yeah. And it's so important,
still
right?
Yeah.
We today, if you and I were to make our own career theory today, it would definitely be called awesome career theory in my mind. But if we were to make our own theory today, we would be trapped in the historical period of today. Right. And I think that we need to give some flexibility and grace to those in the past to recognize that just because they were trapped by history in that time doesn't mean that there wasn't value even today. We just have to adapt it.
Excellent point. Yes. Right.
Yeah. And so when you are studying awesome career theory by Mays and Hutchison in 2047, just give us a little grace. We were trapped in the pandemic, right? When we came up with it. So
the next person that really influenced me was John Holland. And but also, I think that what he did was really brilliant. He found, he discovered, he stumbled on the fact that life can be organized into six personality traits. And that sounds kind of weird, like how can work be organized into personality traits? But his theory was that if you have certain values and certain personality, certain style, that you gravitate toward a certain kind of work. And then as you do that work, you get more embedded in that and you become more like that type of work. And so the categories fit with your personality, but as you get older, they fit more and more.
Yeah, yeah. And so can I sort of adapt that thinking? This is my own point of view. I think it's the same phenomenon as super, where when the world of work was more static for people, right? You got a job at 20 or 18, you retired at 65 or 62, that had a lot more size in its presence in our career decision-making patterns. But today we have so many other factors, right? We don't have the continuity that, you know, we don't continue on the same job, the same career path. We're more global. And so I just feel like that there are a lot of other confounding variables in career development, which is why we've created sort of these companion packages of robustness. So that means that trait factor theory or person environment fit theory, whichever one we're calling Holland's work today, still has an important part to play. And you see this in chaos theory of careers talks about it. You see Savickas talk about it in career construction, right? That it's still a part to play, but now it's sort of put in a broader context because of stuff just got more complicated, I think. Does that ring true for you?
I find it very, very helpful, however. And you know, back when Holland was most popular back in the 80s, all of the career centers were organized by his six categories. I remember when that happened, when everybody tore their career centers apart and started rearranging them by the six personality types, because then you could find the information you were looking for. You kind of get in the right corner and everything was what you wanted to see. The thing now we have is Google.
Right.
And we can search any direction with any characteristic, and we don't need things to be ordered. But back in the days when you had to find things by walking into the right corner, it was very helpful if things were organized in a way that made sense.
And I would say the organization's equally as important today. Again, it's just a smaller piece of the pie in my mind. So knowing my Holland code, right? I'm an SEA. As I'm going through a career development journey, I sort of go away from decisions and look at habits and job categories and look at vectors now, but like the SEA still identifies which is in that pattern vector of other career opportunities for me. It's just, again, the magnitude of it just seems to have shrunk a little bit. That doesn't take away from it in my mind.
Right.
It's an important ingredient in the recipe is how I like to think about it.
I'm an ISA. So we overlap, but
that makes so much sense.
Yes, it does. All that computer background and teaching.
That's right.
Yeah, it fits right in.
Yeah. And then in the modern world, right, where we're much more attuned to diversity of all kinds and globalization, like I love knowing people's Holland codes because it allows me to celebrate you, Marilyn. Like your ISA-ness has been so important in my SEA life because it's open windows for me to learn things from you that I wouldn't have found on my own because I had the blinders on. That was a perfect opportunity for Marilyn to say she wants to celebrate my SEA-ness. She took a pass on that. I'm just going to note that for the record.
No, I think that's a great idea that I could celebrate your SEA-ness too.
You could celebrate it all night long. So for those of you, we are on Zoom right now, even though it's an audio only. So she just cracked a bottle of champagne in celebration of me. And it is still morning time here in the United States. So party hard. Okay. So we've sort of like, in my mind, we've laid the foundation of the theoretical career house here, right? Super Holland. There are many other, you know, we could talk about Ann Rowe and Linda Gottfredson and Sunny Hansen and all of these other sort of pillars, I would say, of the career development before current times, right? The current phase. But really the foundation, I think, is laid by Super and Holland that most other things is built off of. Is that?
Well, there's a lot of other foundation that I don't want to go there because there's just so much.
Okay. Theoretical foundation?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Cool.
And so where my head goes next is what you were just talking about, the chaos that we face today. And I think we have to talk about Jim Bright's chaos theory. He tried to make us aware that this nice, neat little world, the one with the career stages of career development and the six personality types, it was not the way the world worked. Many things happen by accident, and things don't happen as you planned, and you have to be ready for that.
Yeah. And just to be fully comprehensive, I think Robert Pryor also was one of the originators chaos theory. So Jim is definitely the sizzle, but we want to make sure that Robert gets some credit as well. Yeah. And I always have to pause there and say, it's not Richard Pryor. He's the famous comedian. It's Robert Pryor, the famous chaos theorist. So how do you think people understand chaos theory? What is the sense that they try to make of it as they think about applying theory to their own practice?
I think what chaos theory does for us is it helps us to break from that mold of let's march in this direction and see if we get there. And I think a lot of people believe in that, you know, like plan A and then plan B. And if that doesn't work, maybe plan C. And that is just too rigid for today's world. So much goes on, so much happens to us that we aren't expecting, that I think we need to incorporate chaos theory somewhere in this march so that we can recognize that we have to somehow turn on a dime. I know I did. You know, I went from writing software for career planning to organizing events for career counselors. And that was a pretty big change.
How does your ISA-ness cope with planning events?
Oh, it's very well, actually.
You know, for me, I've always thought of chaos theory of careers as sort of two important elements. And the one that I think gets the most shine, if you will, to people is we needed that thick, rich description of how the 21st century world of work is constructed. Like we needed to be given permission to accept it as too chaotic to control, I think. Do you think practitioners resonate with that as well? I mean, that's very much a Brian statement, but do you think that that permission to look at it as more than something that's controllable is an important element?
I think that's an incredible way to summarize it. Yes. And that's, you put it into excellent words. Better than I could.
Yeah. And then the second part for me is, and I think that this is where there's probably still more work to be done, is if chaos is true, what then can we do about it as career service professionals?
Exactly. And we don't want to sit back and say, oh, we can't do anything because of chaos.
This is where the idea of attractor styles really appeals to me within the theory, because the way that they present the attractor styles and measuring them and using them in sessions with clients is that it's we come in with these sort of preset, what's the word I'm looking for? These sort of, we're preset to try to control that chaotic world in a specific way, right? Mm-hmm. As a pendulum attractor or whatever attractor style we might have. And none of those attractor styles, like I'm a weird attractor style, as you would probably guess, right?
Like
that's not ever going to work for me all the time. And it's never going to give me the element of control that I desire, right? In my evolutionary biology. It's never going to give that to me. And so that's why we need someone like a career coach or a career counselor that understands the theory, that can help the client sort of expand their skill set to cope with a chaotic world of work.
That's interesting. That's fascinating. You did that really well. I know when I want to know more about chaos theory, I come to you. That you're my local expert on that subject.
Yeah. And for the listener, so, you know, part of this episode was, is me saying to Marilyn, like, well, I feel like you're the host then. And she's like, we can take turns. We can go back and forth on these things. So I hope that that's coming across to the listener. I have had the privilege of speaking with Jim quite a bit, and I've actually served on, I think, one or two of his students' dissertation committees as he's developed the evidence for chaos theory of careers. And it's something that I find extremely useful in thinking in my conceptualization of working with clients, in psychoeducating them about what the world of work looks like, in helping them identify their attractor style and their attempts to cope with the chaos, and then letting them know you need more to cope with the chaos. Like one style, one approach is never going to allow you to feel the level of control that you desire just as a human animal. And then how do we help them grow? How do we help them develop more approaches to their new understanding of this chaotic world of work is how I've always thought about it in my own practice, at least.
That's a lot more than I knew about chaos theory before. So thank you for that. I appreciate that.
Oh, you know, we'll probably have to have Jim on the podcast sometime to correct me on a lot of that. But I've studied it quite a bit.
You've done really well.
Yeah. So. Cool. So I think a lot of times, like if I go to a big conference, you know, the two names I look for are Bright and Savickas to talk about their theories. I know you have a pretty strong interest in Savickas's theory. Is that correct?
I have worked really hard to become competent in Savickas's process, in his method. And I would not say I'm at all an expert. I'm at the beginning level of competency. But for me, it's a very arduous struggle. It doesn't come naturally because I don't have the magic that he has. And I wish I did. I would love to be able to duplicate what he does. What he's given us is an incredible process for pulling information out of people. And of course, what he says is it's the stories that you have to focus on. And you have to understand the individual's stories. And then he further says, you have to give it back to them in their own words. Yeah. You can rearrange it so that it makes more sense to them and they can see the structure to it. But you have to use their own words when you feed it back to them.
Yeah, and I think that's that heavily narrative influence on it. I use the career construction interview protocol as an intake in my private practice.
Great.
And I said this on a previous episode, but I had a conversation with Dr. Savickas once, and I said, Mark, if you took the word career off the cover, this isn't a career interview. It's a life, you know, it actually comes out of Adler's lifestyle interview. His first publication on this was a chapter I have. I think the initial take on it was Adlerian career counseling. And as he continued to develop it, and I think continued to focus on the narrative elements of it, it became what he's called life design and career construction approaches. And I think career construction is what we're calling it today still.
I just asked him that question. And he said career construction is the one that has worked the best for him.
Yeah. Yep.
I think that if you have the time to really get in depth with a client, it is absolutely fabulous.
Yeah. The thing I hear most, I demonstrate that a couple times a year for teaching purposes. The thing I hear from most from counselors and coaches is the same thing that you brought up, which is that magic element. And as I've distilled that down for me, and again, this is sort of comes out of the Adlerian part of it, it's a highly interpretive approach. So strict narrative is sort of help, you know, a telling and a retelling in the own words. But the way that you interpret the interview protocol, it really does rely on the coach or the counselor to make some interpretations, which we're typically not trained to do, I think, in the career field. When you do the interview yourself and sort of do the restory, the telling back, like how do you experience that active interpretation of taking the question, the headline in the newspaper question, or the three earliest heroes sort of question? How's that interpretation process work for you?
I find that what's really important is that I have to get the words right. I have to take the words that the person actually used and not the ones that stick in my head, which is hard for me, you know, because I may focus on one aspect and one facet of it. And what I have to really feed back is what the person actually focused on and actually cared the most about. And that openness to the feeling element of the client is something that I'm not as skilled at. And I really wish I were.
Yeah,
but I have had some success, especially with other counselors, because they are more understanding that when I make a flub, I'm trying.
Yeah. And I've thought about that. I think counselors tend to struggle with it a little bit less than coaches, as far as the experience of doing it and then the quality of the outcome. And to my mind, the reason is because counselors have to watch themselves on videotape for hundreds of hours to develop those listening skills, right? To develop the metacognitive recall skills of being in the moment, accurately capturing what the client says, and then capturing it in your note, right?
Yes.
And so one way to do that is madly scribbling while the client's talking, which you'll note that Savickas doesn't do. I don't do that either. But to put in the cues that are dependent upon your thousands of hours of therapy practice, you know, to capture that and get an accurate picture on the protocol. That makes it a skill, but it makes it a skill that takes a lot of effort to develop, which is what I think you're saying.
Yes, about 2,000 hours. Yes,
indeed. Yeah, but I agree with you. I think it fits a couple of things. A, it does have consistent impact on, I would say, a large swath of clients, but not every client. I've talked to colleagues that use it. Low clients with less educated and lower, like, working class clients don't seem to resonate to it in the same way.
That's interesting. Wow.
Across a group of us practitioners that use it. And then, of course, the other variable is your skill. as the person doing it and how you have to keep getting better at that.
Right. And I have a feeling that if I'm working with a person whose personality is somehow more like mine, that I'm going to do a better job. Yep. If I'm working with somebody who is a very, very different personality, it's not going to come across well to them at all.
Yeah.
Because I will naturally focus on things that aren't what they're focused on.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a great point. You know, in my consulting work and supervision work, like there is still this push to make therapy and counseling and coaching briefer. And so I do think it gives you a depth approach that kind of fits the brief approach model, and that there's a lot of things that we could develop as a profession to make it more and more useful to more and more people.
And of course, Savick has called his work life design at the beginning, and life design is a very popular name, especially in Europe. And then we have the book called Designing Your Life by Bill Burnett and Dave Evans. So it sounds like they're just talking about the same thing. And you read the book and it is completely different. It is completely different direction. And yes, it is still narrative. And yes, we are still looking at a person's concept of their own life. But the book, as I see it, Designing Your Life, is a very good prescription for how to do career counseling. It's got step-by-step activities that you can use, and every one of them makes sense to me. They are not the activities I personally would choose to use, because in my 50 years of practice, I've done many different things, and some of them I like better, but they've got some good ones in there. The thing that stands out for me in their book, though, is the prototyping. To me, that's what's really important, because even though I would love to have everybody in our field, all career practitioners, read their book and think about how they get through those stages that they talk about, finding your compass and things like that. But once they get to, okay, now what are we going to do? They recommend that instead of putting both feet in the same box, that you first test the water with your toes. And I think that is so important. People tend to plunk down thousands of dollars to get a degree in some kind of field that they think is going to be the best thing they can do. And then they're disappointed and they don't like it when they get done.
Yeah. And I've actually had the privilege of visiting the D School at Stanford University and meeting them a few years back. And I think what's coming to mind with the last three theories that we've covered, with chaos theory of career, Savickas's career construction, and now life design, is that we probably need to build in more models of mentorship and supervision, because the design thinking process. And so what this book is it's applying a process that's been used cross-disciplinary in many disciplines to the process of career development. It's not easy to learn, and it's not easy to do. And I think that, again, it takes intentional practice and some sort of expert insight oversight to do. So the idea of rapid prototyping can easily feel like failing forward, some people would say, failing on purpose. But because of the way many of our educational systems are structured, the idea of telling a client to, I want you to throw out 100 things and accept that 99 of them are going to fail, is really hard to pull off in coaching and counseling sessions effectively.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So I've actually taught and done group interventions with design thinking probably a dozen times now, you know, using this playbook that was put together in the training that I was at. And much like career construction, big impact, but it's a high skill based intervention, I think, for a working coach or counselor.
Interesting.
To be able to do.
It's the brainstorming part that you find is high skill?
No, I think it's the rapid prototyping part. I think it's the sort of reality testing part, where you're supposed to design without worrying. Well, there's also an empathy part, which is hard for some people as well, right? Mm-hmm. So when you go from these early phases of empathy and brainstorming to prototyping, I worry the most about the prototyping phase, because a lot of clients have been conditioned to get it right the first time. It's brainstorming, but the way that I understand life design is the brainstorming is connected to sort of creating something that you're more committed to exploring. And I think that a lot of clients, particularly type A clients, anxious clients, that's really hard for them.
That's a good point. They want to get it right the first time. Right. And that is the whole point. You cannot necessarily get it right the first time,
right,
because you can't know everything about the world. You know, let's say I want to be a chef. I mean, I could go plunk down the money to get a culinary arts school, and I could probably learn the skills in a pretty decent amount of time. But it would be so much more useful if I would first of all spend a couple weeks as a dishwasher, probably watching what's going on, because I may find out that I hate that environment.
Yeah, or cooking at home untrained for your friends and family, so that you can experience the stress of preparing something for someone, not knowing if it's going to be good or not.
Well, I personally think that I've done enough of that, but I have never been in the professional kitchen and the whole idea of producing meals for one after the other. And then the question is, what does the chef really do? Is the chef ordering the food and thinking ahead to the next week and month? And are they trying to redesign the menu? Or is the chef really the one who's tasting the sauce and making sure that it's cooked right?
Yeah.
Which is what I like to do.
And there's shadows of this in our conversations about, particularly about chaos theory of career, where the human need to want to control uncontrollable things, right? That's such a huge thing that I pay attention to in my work as a career services professional. Now, APCDA has sort of been a leader lately in your webinar series, sort of at the forefront of what we're talking about in career services delivery. And I know that we wanted to talk about a couple of your recent guests through APCDA and sort of their emerging ideas. Would you like to start with Dr. Day, with Fruit Day?
Right. We invited Dr. Day to come in and talk to us because he represented for us the Designing Your Life School. And it turned out he didn't. But what he was talking about was something beyond that. His basic premise is that all outcomes need to be available to all people. When he talks about outcomes, he means things we all mean, like skills, like gaining skills, gaining knowledge, and through these things, then gaining fulfillment in your life. But he thinks everyone must be able to have that fulfillment, and that having a pyramid scheme where some people get to the top and the others are still at the bottom is not a good way of the world to work.
Sure. Sounds like someone that wants to dismantle capitalism to me.
And he wants us career professionals to get out of our cubby holes and go out and work with people, basically short-term interventions in which we point people to the right contacts, the right people who can then help them find the mentoring that they need and possibly help them to then make their own plans come true, their own dreams come true. So he's assuming that there's a world of people out there ready and willing to help eager young people and to nurture those young people and get them going in the right direction. And it's not our job to have to do that. We just have to get the young people connected with those other folks out there that are willing to do the actual work of the mentoring.
The exciting thing about this approach for me, and as you know, I do a lot of social justice career work, is that it sounds like the first of the theories that we've talked about right now that are really a structuralist perspective, that are not focused on individuals and their individual career journey and how they're navigating this external system. But it's saying, yeah, we have to help individual people in groups of people, but the structure or the environment within which they operate, within which they navigate the system of the world of work, is something worth paying attention to as well. And so is this a mentor model? Is that the way?
Yeah, the career professional becomes the person who helps with the connections so that you can find the right people and helps to figure out which direction you want to go and look for find people, and then do your rapid prototyping with those people that you have just talked to or just found.
Right. So it's sort of in a life design concept, but whereas life design is as presented in the book and from the D School, it's a very problem-based approach, right? It's a very identify the problem and then rapid prototype to figure out a way to solve this particular career problem. I think.
Right. And the book is more like what career practitioners traditionally do. We take people through the steps. We work with them from the beginning to the end. Mm-hmm. This approach is no, we don't do that. We let them do all that stuff. All we do is connect them to the right people, and then they're on their own. Of course, we have to realize that Dr. Day worked first at Stanford and then at Johns Hopkins University, which are both full of really high-powered students who really know what they're doing. And you can maybe point them in the right direction and they can find their own way, possibly more than the average population.
And so it's a social capital theory question is, you know, I don't remember if they did this back in your research classes, but Yavis, right? If you want to pick an intervention and you want it to work, it is always best to apply it to young, attractive, verbal, intelligent, and social human beings.
Oh, there you go.
And so almost any type of educational, therapeutic, career intervention is going to have better outcomes with Yavis clients versus the opposite. And so when we look at the way the world is constructed, that's always the problem, right? Is that the consistency of delivery across the strata of socioeconomic capital highly differentiates the ability to deliver and then also the outcomes, you know, we find.
So talented clients actually produce better outcomes. Yes.
Heck yeah. Heck yeah. And so it also, you know, in fairness to Dr. Day, using these more privileged spaces to test out initial ideas and then trying to find ways to apply them in less privileged spaces. That's not bad science. That's not a bad way to start to go about these processes.
And he's right. It does allow you to get a lot more to help a lot more people at the same time.
Sure.
It was very interesting to see how Dr. Rich Feller put that together, because mm-hmm. he worked with us in this very same question of trying to talk to each other and understand where our field is headed. And he put together his takeaways from this in a triangle. He said, we're looking for low cost, we're looking for high quality, and we're looking for access for all. And if you think of that as a triangle, then the solution is in the middle of it. And this is very hard, how to get the cost down as low as you possibly can, not to work with individuals for long periods of time, but to work with them for short periods of time, still have an in-depth experience, and how to make this something that everybody, all people in the world, could have access to.
Yeah. And that just sounds like a challenge that has been around since the tribes moved to urban environments.
Well, sure, it was part of my thinking when I started computerized career planning.
Yeah. So in the realm of computerized career guidance, having been there sort of since the genesis of that, what has kept that particular approach from getting this high quality, low cost available to all? Because, well, you know, we've been doing that for about 50 years now, roughly, you know, are we any better off on those three metrics than we were 50 years ago? And where do we see that improvement and the places where we might be failing?
You've just entered a whole new discussion. The problem with this discussion is economics. Back in about the 1990s, the U.S. government decided that it was going to give all of these services away for free. And all development ceased because there was no more income possible, since the federal government was giving away excellent services for free. Okay, so that ended that topic. So let's not talk about that.
Sure. And is that ONET today?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm, that's right. And it's available to the whole world.
Yeah, which again, I think is high quality. I mean, I use it in my private practice because I don't see the point in charging my clients for, you know, specific measures that really aren't that different as far as the quality and the outcomes.
Right. Might as well give them free assessments. And then that doesn't hurt anybody to take a free assessment.
Yeah. So how do we wrap up? We went through the list of theories and stuff that you wanted to talk about. How do we wrap this conversation up to be most useful?
Well, I see a number of different directions. I see some of us really focusing on the individual and trying to find their stories and trying to understand who they are and help them figure that out in their lives. I see other people focusing on the practical side of things, of how to get that done less, more efficiently and with less expense, and trying to provide some kind of quality at the same time. But I am not sure that these are actually going in a different direction. I think that what we may be doing is trying to get really better at all of these things simultaneously.
Mm. Tell me a little bit about how that concerns you.
It concerns me in the sense that I think people look at all these different possibilities basically swirling around in our heads. And until they fall into some kind of pattern for us, it's very confusing.
Yeah. And I see that a lot in the field too. You know, I know a lot of people in professional career services that are sort of playing the whack-a-mole approach to their personal education, where it's like, this month I'm going to a workshop on this perspective and approach. This month I'm going to a workshop on this perspective and approach. And I see that in my own trainings as well. And I think at some point, specialization matters, and that we might want to encourage career professionals to sort of, at least as a starting point, pause and go deeper with something that is a good fit for them in the work that they have in front of them today, instead of sort of wandering around the wilderness, just trying. That's just my personal opinion on it.
But that's a really good point, because if you're in a setting where you have the time to work with individuals in depth, then, you know, the Civicus method works great. And maybe that's really a good answer for you. But if you're in another setting where you need to see a lot of people very quickly, you need something that's more adaptable in a classroom setting.
Yeah. And letting that sort of drive, and I'm guilty of this as well. There's so many of us out there with some level of expertise that's sort of promoting or marketing our own individual thing. It's super easy to be passive as a career professional and just spend your professional development budget on the next thing that sounds like interesting, or the next person that's known, or something like that. that instead of actually taking some design elements to your own professional development. I have a great example. I work with a colleague who is in the United States, but works a lot in China as a Chinese American, is getting an educational technology education degree from Harvard right now to learn the theory and the approaches to apply her career coaching model in an online environment so that she can, because China's really grown for her during the pandemic, right?
Yes.
And so, you know, it's almost like we should be reading the life design book or design your life book and applying that to our own professional development sometimes is what it feels like to me.
That's a great suggestion. I love it. Well, I'm not going to come up with answers. I don't have answers. I'm going to only come up with questions.
I'm probably guilty of at least both. So how can people, if they don't know you and your work, find you? Is there a website or are you active on any social media or is it through the APCDA website?
Yeah, I'm on APCDA constantly. Okay. Just AsiaPacificCDA.org.
I will make sure that I put that in the programming notes as well as a couple of the webinars that we've directly addressed in this conversation today. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Marilyn Mays, for coming on and having, I don't know, this felt like a really interesting, wide-ranging conversation. With some nuggets in it, but again, encouraging our listeners that are in the career development profession to explore some of these ideas further instead of just skimming the surface a little bit seems like a point of agreement. So until next time, this is Brian Hutchison, your host, signing off.